I'm Shauna Ritter, and welcome to Profiles from WFIU. On Profiles, we talk to notable artists, scholars, and musicians, and get to know the person behind the persona. Our guest today is Samrat Upadhyay. Samrat is the author of a number of novels and short story collections, including Arresting God in Kathmandu, which won the Whiting Award, The Royal Ghosts and the Guru of Love, which was a New York Times notable book and a San Francisco Chronicle best book of the year. His newest book is Buddha's Orphans. He has written for the New York Times and appeared on BBC Radio and NPR. Samrat is also the director of the Creative Writing Program at Indiana University. Thank you for being here today.
Oh, it's a delight.
Good. Tell me a little bit about growing up in Nepal.
I grew up in a middle-class family in Nepal. My parents had the foresight to enroll me in a Jesuit school run by American priests, basically out of the Midwest. So I got a very good education in the English language. And I started reading the Hardy Boys and the Nancy Drew and, you know, the Tarzan series at a very young age. And I was writing in English at a very young age. I started going to college in Nepal, and then there were, you know, the colleges went on strike, and I felt that I could do something better with my life. And that's when I applied to a few schools in the United States and came here in 1984 when I was about 21.
Tell me a little bit, when you say a middle-class family in Nepal, was that in Kathmandu?
Yes, this is in Kathmandu. My parents work for governmental organizations, and, you know, we had a small house. We used to live in rented apartments for a long time. And I think when I was in fourth grade, we started building our own house in Kathmandu, which is a pretty big deal. I had enough to, buy clothes. My parents bought me bell-bottom pants when I was growing up. You know, I had a cassette player. I used to listen to the Grateful Dead and the Neil Young. So a regular humdrum middle-class existence.
So when you first moved to the U.S. about age 21, where did you go in the U.S.?
I first attended Coe College in Iowa for about a semester, and then I went to College of Worcester in Ohio, in Worcester, Ohio. And when I initially came here, I love writing, but I didn't know that you could actually pursue a career in writing. So I thought I would major in business because that's what, you know, everyone did. And I had studied a little bit of what it called commerce in Nepal. And then I found out that within one semester that I was no good in accounting. I mean, I started doing really badly. And then I thought, well, let me just, you know, take classes that I'm interested in. And I veered towards literature and theater. And I ended up majoring in English.
Did the Midwest feel familiar to you, having studied with Americans from the Midwest?
Well, I knew about the Cincinnati Reds because the fathers, you know, loved talking about them. And I had heard a great deal about Chicago. But that was the extent of it. I mean, I had no clue as to what America was like. What I had seen was basically came from movies and came from songs. I remember I used to listen to Neil Young's Ohio, the Four Dead in Ohio song. And while I listened to it in Nepal, the lyrics didn't make any meaning to me. I mean, I just liked the song. And it was only after coming here, you know, then I understood what the significance, the whole Kent State, you know, affair and stuff like that. So there was a bit of a shock. I remember the biggest shock for me was how big America was. Nepal is a very small country.
It's a 500 miles long, I think.
Yes, about that. It's the size of Arkansas. So Arkansas is the state that closest, you know, resembles the size. And just how huge America was, and you could just keep going for a long time, and you know, and all these big cities. Kathmandu is a fairly crowded city, but it's still a fairly small city.
Is middle-class life in Kathmandu similar to middle-class life in Columbus, Ohio?
That's a tough question because one of the surprising things for me when I came here was my friend took me around to the countryside in West Virginia, and he pointed to some houses and he said, these people are dirt poor. And I saw satellite dishes, you know, on those houses. And that was not my idea of poverty that I had seen in Nepal. So I think there is some difference in terms of how middle class is defined. I think one of the characteristics of middle class in Nepal, at least in terms of my growth, was the emphasis on education, that my parents had. But I think in terms of like luxuries, I think the middle class here has more luxuries. That's how I would define it.
Mm-hmm. What else as a Westerner is essential for me to know in order to understand something more about Nepal?
Well, Nepal has a lot of mountains. It has, I think, like six of the top, the highest mountains in the world are in Nepal. Sometimes people ask me, like, when they hear I'm from Nepal, they say, oh, so, you know, even in the midst of winter in America, they'll say, oh, so this is not, you know, this is not cold for you at all. And that's not true because we never saw snow in Kathmandu. Nepal has different, you know, topographies, mm-hmm. and different climates. You get, like, you know, the very hot in the south and then the sort of the mid-temperature and then the very cold. There are still places in Nepal where you don't have electricity, and I think that's something that that for Americans is kind of hard to fathom. There are still places where you have to walk for days to reach from one village to another. So there are quite a bit of differences in terms of America and Nepal.
Everything I've read of yours thus far, the two collections of short stories and both the novels take place in Nepal, specifically in Kathmandu. Mm-hmm. Why do you choose – you've lived here longer, I think, than you lived there. Why do you choose to have that be your setting still?
Well, it might not even be a matter of choice. They say the subject matter chooses you, right? There's something about Nepal. I mean, most of my emotional growth took place in Nepal. I was there until I was 21, and then my intellectual and my academic growth has taken place here. I think there is a kind of a rootedness there that I go back to. The well-known writer Salman Rushdie, used the term imaginary homelands when he talked about this sort of bifurcated view that the exile writer has. There's a sort of emotional power when I write about Nepal, although I think that is shifting now, because I have written like four books that are, exclusively set in Nepal. So I am attempting to write a little bit about America, but then I do have Nepali characters, in those stories too. So.
You've written all your books in English from the first draft on, everything in English?
Yes, I write in English, I think in English, and a lot of times I dream in English. I think I lost my ability with the Nepali language, at least in terms of literary writing, sometime when I was a teenager, primarily because I attended a Jesuit school and then I had access to more English books. I have tried writing in Nepali, but I can only write journalistic pieces. I cannot plumb the depths that, literary writing requires.
How did you first – you mentioned that you didn't do so well in commerce and it occurred to you that maybe writing would pull you. Was there something driving you toward writing before that, or did you stumble onto writing?
No, I used to write when I was a very young kid. I remember when I was in fourth grade, I wrote a poem in Nepali about my neighborhood and the different people who inhabited the neighborhood and how they were nice to me. And, I used to go into different houses and eat all kinds of food and things like that. I was also the editor of the school magazine. Wow. So I used to, I used to write. But I really didn't know that you could make a career in writing. I mean, if someone had told me at the time that I would be director of creative writing, you know, in a well-known English department, I could not have imagined this sort of a position for myself. I thought if anything I would use my writing towards journalism. And that's what I ended up doing. I was a journalist for a while, and then I did a master's in journalism at Ohio University, and then discovered writing again. So,
And you write both, correct? Do you continue to write journalistic pieces as well?
I do, but not on a regular. I mean, I sometimes write columns. I used to write more of those. So sometimes when people request, I write columns or short nonfiction pieces.
And how does being director of a writing program, which requires a lot of administrative time as well, affect your own writing?
It's become more frazzled in the past 3 years that I've written. I mean, luckily, I had done a majority of the work on Buddha's Orphans before I became the director. So I did a lot of editing while I was the director, at least the first year. So it is hard. I mean, I have to find snatches of time here and there. I tend to be an early morning writer, so I get up really early. And if I don't sort of get pulled into email, I can, you know, write a couple of passages. So with the administrative job, it's a little bit hard. But I have learned. I mean, one of the things I did with Buddha's Orphans was I sort of went against my own patterns. I used to think that I was only an early morning writer. And then I decided, well, I'll just write in the afternoons and see what happens. And, you know, I wrote in the afternoons. I wrote in airports. So I did, and I found that a lot of these things are myths that we create in our own minds about the kinds of, you know, the process that we need.
Talking about writing process, do you tend to conceptualize an entire book and then write it out? Or do you start with characters? Or how do you begin?
I start with an image and a character, and sometimes that takes a while in the sense that the image has to have a degree of potency for me to feel that it has a momentum that I can, you know, take into the days and weeks to come. I do not plot out my stories, and actually even Buddha's Orphans, the monster of a novel it is, I actually wrote it without any plot outline, which at times was really hard. But I tend to trust the inner process. And I realize that this is not the same for all the writers.
Right.
I mean, there are writers who plot out their, you know, novels and do it quite well. With me, if I plot it out, I'm afraid of being too constricted in my own plottiness and not let the novel, you know, find its own flavor. Because, you know, I think all writers know that there are moments when characters will do things that surprise you, and you need to be open to that process.
In all of the stories and in both your novels, there's glimpses of the political life of Nepal. How much does the political life of Nepal play into and out of your characters as you're writing?
That's an interesting question, and I think that's something that the form of the novels that I'm writing, that in itself is a reflection of that question, because I think at least in Asia or in Nepal, individual is history, to a certain extent, and the political life goes on at the, you know, on a daily basis, and then there are these individual micro domestic lives that are also happening simultaneously. And sometimes they intersect, sometimes there are mere noises in the background, and sometimes they don't seem to matter at all. And I think in both, The Guru of Love as well as in Buddha's Orphans, and probably more in Buddha's Orphans because it covers a very large, longer span of time, there's that sort of going in and going out. So the political life comes into focus and then it retreats to the background and comes into focus again. And that's been my experience of how it has been for Nepal. For example, during the heyday of the Maoist movement, when the Maoists were going around and killing a lot of people, it was very much at the forefront of every Nepali's mind. And there was a degree of urgency there. And right now, you know, you go to Nepal and people are just kind of resigned to, oh, yeah, it's politics as usual. So there's that ebb and flow that happens, you know, in terms of Nepali political life.
How different is politics now in 2011 in Nepal than during the largest recent changeover in 2006, I think it was?
Yeah, the 2006. So the Maoist, you know, movement started around 1995. The way it has shifted now is that it has stabilized to a great extent. So the kind of uncertainty that there was, you know, until a few years ago is no longer there. We had another great momentous, you know, event that happened, you know, just a couple of 3 years ago, which was that the king got booted out, you know, and you're looking at centuries of monarchical history in Nepal, and the king got kicked out of the palace. In a very casual way, it was very shocking in some ways, and I actually visited the palace fairly recently because it has been turned into a museum now, and the home where I grew up in Kathmandu was just a block away from the palace. And when I was a teenager, I used to pass by the palace, and the palace was shrouded in a kind of a mystery. You know, we always used to imagine what it was like inside. And when I visited it this time, it was not as opulent as we, you know, as we thought. I mean, it was, you know, there were these small rooms, there were these small beds, and so that was another sort of a reality check in terms of how we thought it was and what it really was.
And now there's no standing monarchy at all in Nepal.
No,
not even as a figurehead.
No, not even as a figurehead, which is surprising because we all thought that, you know, at least the monarchy would stick around as sort of like the British system.
And just another clarification for me: the Maoist movement in Nepal was not at all related to the Maoist movement in China. Is that correct?
The name obviously comes from Chairman Mao, but when the Maoist uprising started, China disavowed right. Nepali Maoists in a sense of irony. You know, they're likened to the shining path of Peru.
Raja, who's the protagonist in Buddha's Orphan, I think it's interesting too that he goes in and out of political awareness and
yes.
political involvement mm-hmm. during his time period. Very much as you said, the politics have been more in the front or
right.
less contingent.
Right.
You said you were going to read a short piece from Buddha's Orphans?
Yes, I'd be happy to. I thought I would just read the opening scene of Buddha's Orphan. So this is the scene where we discover Raja as a baby, and I don't think I need to explain anything. So let me just read it.
Okay.
Raja's mother had abandoned him on the parade ground of Tunic Hill on a misty morning before Kathmandu had awakened, then drowned herself in Ranipokhari, half a kilometer north. No one connected the cries of the baby to the bloated body of the woman that would float to the surface of the pond later that week. The school leaving certificate exam results had just been published in Gorkhapatra, so everyone deduced that the woman, like a few others already that year, in 1962, had killed herself over her poor performance. That morning, Kaki was at Ranipokhari getting ready to sell her corn on the sidewalk. When she saw Bokeba approach from the parade ground area, carrying something on his palms, as if balancing a tray. "After ages, Bokeba is coming to visit me," Kaki said to the woman who was sweeping the sidewalk in front of the shoe shop, where Kaki sold her corn. Bokeba, so-called because of the goat-like beard hanging from his chin, was a derelict who'd made the parade ground his home for no one knew how long. He knelt in front of Kaki. In his arms was a baby swaddled in a woman's dirty shawl. Kaki let out a gasp. "Whose baby did you steal? Look, Vaishali, come here." Vaishali ambled over. Her hand flew to her mouth. "Let's fetch the police," she said to Kaki. "What did this nutcase do?" "Whose baby is this?" Kaki spoke loudly, even though Bokeba wasn't hard of hearing. "Tell me, where did you get it?" She gingerly reached over and lifted the shawl. "It's a boy," she whispered, "and barely a few months old. Bokeba, what are you doing with this baby?" Bokeba tried to form the words, but they didn't come. It had literally been months since he'd talked to anyone. He pointed behind him toward Tunic Hill. "Where's the baby's mother?" Bokeba shrugged, cleared his throat, and managed to hoarsely say, "Don't know." "So why bring him here?" Vaishali said. "Take him back. What can we do?" "Wait," Kaki told her. "Let me look." Bokeba handed her the baby, and thinking that his job was done, he stood and was about to leave when Kaki yelled at him, "Where are you going? Sit." Bokeba sat on his haunches. Kaki inspected the baby's face, running her fingers over it. "He seems healthy enough." The baby began to cry again, and she said, "Maybe he's hungry." Her maternal instincts made her want to open her blouse and let the baby feed on her breasts, but she realized how foolish that was. A dry woman, past middle age, in a crowded street, feeding a baby she didn't know. So she requested that Vaishali mind her corn station as she and Bokeba looked for the baby's mother. For the rest of the morning, Kaki and Bokeba roamed the area in search of someone who'd claim the baby. Kaki walked in front, clutching the baby to her chest, already feeling protective. She puckered her lips in kisses at him whenever he cried. They circled Rani Pokhri, where the mother's body now rested at the bottom of the pond. The pond was said to be haunted at night by ghosts of those who had committed suicide in its waters and those who had been repeatedly dunked as state punishment until they could no longer breathe. But for the restless students at Trichandra College, the sight of the pond had a calming effect as they skipped classes and spent hours on the roof, smoking, discussing politics. It had been more than 2 years since King M's coup, and he showed no sign of returning power to the elected officials.
Thank you so much for reading that from Buddha's Orphans. Was that based, the original notion of finding a young baby in the park like that, was that based on a real occurrence that happened?
No, but the image of a young woman committing suicide in Rani Pokhri Pond was based on certain reports I'd heard, about young women jumping into the pond because they didn't do well in their exams. The pond is a real pond. It's in the middle of, if you actually go on Google Earth and you type in Kathmandu, the pond is where the camera focuses on. The pond comes with a lot of myths and legends, and that was certainly one of them, that it was a place for suicide. Before modern suicide methods were invented, that was an easy form of suicide for young folks in Kathmandu.
I think so much for me of the relationships in Buddha's Orphans explore relationships between mothers and their children, mothers who adopt children, yeah, mothers who have children and ignore them.
Right.
And then, of course, the relationship between the two lovers. What pushed you to look at that parental relationship and go into that much more than you had in Guru of Love, which was really much more of looking at a couple relationship?
Well, that could be because I became a parent myself and realized the joys and the anxieties that come from parenthood. I also wrote it partly because my parents have been hugely influential in my own, upbringing and the kind of sacrifices that they had to make. I mentioned earlier that, we're from a middle-class family. But when they initially got married, they had to struggle a lot and they provided a lot for their children. And so I think some of that is reflected in the kind of relationships the parents have with the children. So I was just trying to show the idea of parents and especially mothers as sort of an approximation of this great love that exists in our world, because I think parents provide that for kids.
They're also very fallible.
Yes, very very fallible, and also that can lead to a lot of suffering because the other protagonist, or who turns out to be actually the main protagonist of the novel as the novel progresses, Nilu, her relationship with her mother is filled with sorrow. Her mother doesn't provide her with the kind of nurturing that she's looking for. She also feels a lot of compassion for her mother, even as she ages. I think she sort of the love that she doesn't get from her mother, she transfers onto her own daughter in the kind of love and caring that she provides for her. So there is that transference part too, that I'm, you know, the kind of inheritance, you know. I'm very interested in the idea of us being connected through history. And so the novel, all, you know, in Buddha's Orphans, you have six decades of Nepali history, you know, and how it moves from one to the other. And also the idea of, you know, transference even in terms of individual families and individual lives.
Talk a little bit more about the notion of how we're connected in history as individuals, because you started to say something about that before as well.
You know, I don't think I have a very precise answer, or, you know, I mean, I don't want to sound pedantic, but it seems to me that the idea of us as solitary individuals who lead these solitary lives, it's increasingly, as I age, it just doesn't sound like, that doesn't hold much water for me, because it seems like we are so much connected in all different ways. And I think, you know, like, for example, I find myself, the more I age, I find myself that I have certain characteristics and mannerisms that resemble my father, which I had never thought that, you know, which I wouldn't have thought about when I was a teenager. So there are all these transferences that are happening on a very subtle level. So there's that. And then we are all, you know, connected to each other too. In what we do as individuals affect our families, it affects our communities, it affects our environment, as we're discovering, you know, now. So the idea of, you know, this interdependence is hugely interesting to me.
I want to talk about Guru of Love for a few minutes, sure. Which you wrote about 10 years ago? No.
About 10 years now. Right. Correct. I wrote it right after my daughter was born. And I remember, because she was, you know, she was a baby, and I was getting up very early. And interestingly, you know, despite the demands of a young, you know, being a young father, I had enormous focus at that time, which, when I think about it now, I find it very surprising that how is that possible? But that's the way it was, and so that's why I partly dedicate the book to my daughter, and I say that the energy for writing the book comes from her.
Well, the protagonist, I'm forgetting his name,
Ramchandra.
Ramchandra, yeah. Thank you so much, and his wife Goma, yeah. Really explores their relationships. But as a woman reading the book, I don't think I'll give away too much if I say that Ramchandra has a relationship with another woman.
Right.
But the shocking part to me is how Goma reacts to that, that she becomes so solid in herself. Mm-hmm. Why did you take her in that direction?
Actually, I remember that moment vividly in the writing of the novel. I had come to an impasse there, or, you know, in traditional terms, people talk about writer's block. I no longer use the term writer's block, because I find that the term itself limiting. But there was an impasse where, you know, Ramchandra and Malati have this affair, and then Goma finds out about it, and then what? You know, I mean, what, you know, if Goma merely like walked away, then there would be a great deal of predictability to the novel. I mean, this is a story that's been told a lot of times. And so this that just didn't seem like the right move for the novel for me. And I was thinking about it, and I also like to play with the idea of opposites when I'm writing, you know, in the sense that, you know, if I say that a character is like this, then I say, well, what if the character acts in an opposite way than how I want the character to behave? And that's when the idea of, well, what happens if Goma as a character challenges Ramchandra? because I wanted Ram Chandra to be challenged so much that he's trembling by the end of the novel and comes to a different realization.
Not the most sympathetic of characters.
No, he's not. But then I've never gone for the most sympathetic of characters anyway. That doesn't seem to be like a crucial component. I think a level of engagement and interestedness in the protagonist is important, but maybe not.
What makes you interested in a character?
Well, I think what makes me interested is if I put a character in a difficult situation that has moral implications, then to me that is interesting. So the character doesn't need to be hugely sympathetic or goody-two-shoes. Just the character needs to. I tell this to my students: you need to give your protagonist a problem to solve within the course of the story. So if you look at the story as a problem and the solution, so what is the problem that your protagonist is going to solve? So in Ramchandra's case, I mean, it's a problem of how is he going to manage this impulse towards, this external love that he has, which is coming from partly due to the stress that he feels about from his in-laws, versus this, great internal love that is already existent within his own family in the form of his wife and his children. So that is something that he needs to discover by the end.
And this seems like a perfect moment for you to read a little piece from Guru of Love.
Sure. I'm going to read a section I call the monkey scene. In the first part of the novel, this is so the novel is Ramchandra, who is a math tutor, and there's this young girl, young single mother, who comes to him for some help with math because she wants to pass the school leaving certificate exam, and he ends up having an affair with her. And this scene is when they first have a meeting outside the apartment where he teaches her, and this takes place in a large temple complex, which is a real temple complex in Kathmandu. And it was important for me to get the two characters out of the house so that they could have some kind of a rendezvous. And I can talk a little bit about what happens after I read the section. They wandered through the woods behind them and finally found shelter in a ruined, abandoned temple. Inside, it was nearly dark. A stone statue of Lord Ganesh lay in the corner, the lower half of its elephant trunk broken. Someone had painted a red mustache above the statue's upper lip so that it looked like a warrior with a broken nose. Cobwebs hung from the corners, and the floor was dusty. Ramchandra wrapped his hand around Malti's waist and pulled her toward him. He lowered her to the floor, and at once both of them sneezed from the dust. They laughed. She stroked the back of his head. His lips against hers, he fumbled with the buttons of her blouse. He felt a tug at his trousers and thought it was her hand, but then he turned and saw a large monkey. It was an arm's length away, watching them. Ramchandra waved a hand to shoo away the monkey, but it blinked once and kept gazing, its eyes watery, as if the creature were saddened by the sight of the two. Malti let out a cry. Ramchandra heaved himself up from the floor and was looking for something to throw at the monkey when two more monkeys entered the temple. All three sat on their haunches and observed Ramchandra and Malti. "Do something," Malti cried, and Ramchandra, scanning the floor, saw the broken elephant trunk lying beside the statue. He picked it up and hurled it at the animals, who merely ducked their heads. A few more monkeys now stood at the entrance of the temple. "Hurry," Ramchandra told Malti. "Let's go." But Malti was frozen on the floor. One of the monkeys approached her and, grabbing the end of her sari, tugged at it, and it began to unwind. Another monkey joined the effort, and soon there was a tug of war between the monkeys and Malti. Malti was screaming, pulling the edges of her sari, while the monkeys, chattering, tugged with great vigor. Ramchandra threatened and shouted, but the monkeys at the entrance had sidled toward him, some of them baring their teeth. Then, incredibly, in one swift motion, Malti's sari was in a large monkey's hand, part of it covering its body so that it looked as if it was the one wearing the blue sari. It ran out the entrance, the sari trailing behind. Malti, in her petticoat and her blouse, feebly tried to cover her chest with her hands while she whimpered and tears streamed down her face. And then, as if it had all been a big show, the monkeys left the temple one by one.
Production support for Profiles comes from Smithville, a locally owned business serving central and southern Indiana since 1922, with residential and business internet, voice, and security services. Smithville, local pride, global technology. Information at smithville.net.
How did you get the ideas for the monkeys coming in to interrupt them?
Well, the monkeys are a regular feature of this particular temple. And they roam around in large hordes. While I was writing this scene, once I had Ramchandra and Malti in the woods and in the temple complex, I thought, well, this can't go right for them. I mean, this cannot be a regular love scene, because there are moral implications for Ramchandra, and I wanted to turn it up the notch, you know, a notch in terms of the relationship. And then I just had a vision of a monkey appearing, and I thought, oh, this is interesting, you know, and I just took it from there. And I really enjoyed, you know, writing it, and it becomes a turning point for Ramchandra too, you know, in terms of his involvement with Malti.
I've heard you referred to quite often as a Buddhist Chekhov in some of the reviews. How does that inference make you feel?
Well, I mean, I think it's the writer's job to write their stuff, and then, you know, reviewers and critics will say what they, you know, what they want to say. I think this particular reviewer was seeing like certain elements of the Buddhist philosophy in my writing, which is true, in the sense that, you know, I am interested in Buddhism in that that sense. But
what elements would those be?
The idea I talked about earlier, you know, the idea of interconnectedness, which is, you know, which is Buddhism, what something Buddhism talks about. And I'm very interested in the notion of karma, and in Buddha's orphan that, you know, that karma also, you know, comes into play, you know, especially toward the end, with the young daughter's experiences in America and then her return back home. Yet I don't like limitations of labels. So that's fine for a reviewer to say. But I might surprise my readers with something else. You know, that is not Buddhist-like or Chekhovian. So,
and did you grow up as a practicing Buddhist in Nepal?
Nepal has a good mixture of Hinduism and Buddhism. Gautama Buddha was born in present-day Nepal, so a lot of Nepalese are incredibly, like, you know, they're sort of proud of that fact. And we have a lot of Buddhist temples. So when I was growing up, I attended Buddhist temples without, you know, thinking that they were Hindu or Buddhist. And there are a lot of deities that Hinduism and Buddhism, share in Nepal. So it's a little bit complex.
And the Jesuit school did that?
the Jesuit school were not, I mean, they did not try to convert us at all. And I'm really grateful to them for that. We did have to recite the Lord's Prayer during the morning assembly, but it never occurred to me that it was a Christian. It was a specifically Christian prayer, because maybe in my mind I just thought of, I don't know, whoever, Lord Shiva or whoever, you know, Lord Thou art in heaven, you know. So it didn't bother me.
You found the universal.
That's right. Yeah.
We were going to listen to a piece of music that you brought that's rather special to you, that are chants. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, these are chants in Tibetan, sung by Anichoing Dolma, who is actually a Nepali singer. So I find them very soothing and beautiful. Uh, uh, I don't I know they are geared towards certain, you know, deities, you know, and there's a one that is called Om Mani Padme Hum, which is a regular Buddhist chant. But I don't understand Tibetan, so I don't know, like, you know, all the meanings, but I find them very, very soothing to listen to.
We've been listening to Ani Choyeng Dolma, who's been chanting from the Tibetan tradition. Did I get that right?
Tibetan Buddhist tradition, yes.
Thank you very much. Tell me a little bit more about what some things are that you might be working on starting now. You've inferred a few things that something may not be taking place in Nepal, a new piece. What are you working on now?
Well, I have a very rough draft of a story collection that I'm working on, and it has characters. I guess I've been asked this question a lot of times before, whether, you know, the people, especially Nepalese residing in the United States, they'll say, why don't you write about the immigrant experience? Because you've been here long enough, and I've told him always, well, I've not been that interested in it, you know, until now. I think I might be getting a little bit more interested in it now. So I do have in this particular story collection, I do have characters who are immigrants or at various stages of immigration, although they're, you know, Nepal still features fairly strongly. I also recently started a novel. It's at a very sort of rudimentary state, and I don't like talking about, you know, but in which it actually starts out in America with a Nepali character. But I figure we're going to be end up doing maybe some back and forth between Nepal and the United States. So there's a movement, you know. I think I'm moving out of, like, the strictly Nepal, you know, territory.
We'll see what happens,
yeah,
right?
Yes.
You talked about liking to put your characters in a problematic situation and seeing how they deal with that. Mm-hmm. Over the time you've been writing, have you found that the ways in which your characters respond to problematic situations are shifting? Are they having a larger repertoire of responses? Do the essence of them change?
Well, I think there's a kind of a maturation that you go through the more you write. I think perhaps in my earlier work, the problem might have been kind of one-dimensional, and then the solution might also have been one-dimensional. And I think in my current writing, the problem, even though it might be a singular problem that I might have introduced, the more I write, the more I find that it has multiple dimensions. And I think those dimensions were in existence even before in my earlier writing, but I was simply not aware of them, you know. And I think, you know, even the solutions when I you know, have them might have multiple dimensions. And I think that's one of the reasons that writing is this, you know, it never ends, in the sense that there are so many things to discover. And with each new book, I find that I'm starting all over again. You know, this is so there's a great deal of excitement in that, you know, because all of a sudden you're a young writer starting, you know, out this new project, And then there's also a lot of anxiety with it. When I was a young writer, I used to think that all I had to do was write my first book. And then that was it. After that, you know, it would be all like, you know, honey and roses. I know I would have – I'd mastered the craft and everything. It's turned out to be exactly the opposite. Each new book has its own requirements and its own challenges that are, you know, very different. So there is no mastery in this field. You're still very much a student, and there's so much to discover.
Do you have certain characters that you fall in love with and others that you find that you don't like very well?
I think there are certain characters I'm very fond of, like Goma in Guru of Love is obviously one. Nilu in Buddha's Orphans, and Kaki particularly in Buddha's Orphans, the woman who the corn seller who raises Raja is a woman is a character that I'm fond of. I don't think I ever create characters that I completely dislike. I think that's very hard to do because then that disliked character becomes very one-dimensional and you don't do justice to a character like that. So I think even the most villainous of characters have to have, you know, some kind of dimension to them. In Buddha's Orphans, I think Nilu's mother, you know, she kind of redeems herself by the end. Nilu's mother's lover, he also sticks with her, you know, through thick and thin, even though Nilu thinks that, you know, he'd probably leave her, so it doesn't happen.
Favorite characters for you from other writings? Do you have any that you hold very near and dear?
I think Kafka's, Gregor Samsa has to be like one of my all-time, favorite characters.
Why?
This idea of this man oppressed, you know, by his work, and then turns into this bug, and then is shunned by his family, yet leads to a transformation that is very beautiful, you know. Among the more contemporary novels, I think Kazuo Ishiguro's *The Remains of the Day*, the butler in *The Remains of the Day*, is a very vivid character for me. So,
and again, because.
Well, because I think and a lot of it has to do with the form of that particular novel in itself, the amount of repression that this character sort of inflicts upon himself. Yet he's such an adorable character. You feel so much for him. And all the time you see, you know, his foolishness and, you know, and especially his inability to express love to this, to Miss Kenton. It just, you know, you want to shake him because, you want to shake him saying like, come on, you know, can't you see it? You love her, you know. But of course, you know, I think that's Ishiguro's, you know, I mean, that's how the novel is. He handles the novel. So
that's the brilliance,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
What's on your night table right now? Or do you keep books on your night table?
I do. I have so many books. I think my daughter has inherited this habit. She has like, you know, four books by the night table and six books, you know, downstairs in the living room. I have a book called a story collection called I believe the title is Freedom. It's about, you know, stories about freedom and Amnesty International. Mm-hmm. And so stories that deal with the idea of human freedom and repression. And so on. And then I have a couple of Buddhist texts that I read. One is called Teachings from the Heart by Tarthang Tulku, who's a Nyingma master out of California. Let's see. I have a couple of other books. I can't remember what they are. Yeah. Maybe I'm pretty sure I have a craft book, you know.
What kind of craft?
Well, the craft of writing. When I say craft, it has to do with writing. So.
Okay. We've been speaking with novelist Samrat Upadhyay here on Profiles. Samrat, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
The program you just heard was recorded in March of 2011. The studio engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Production support for Profiles comes from Smithville, a locally owned business serving central and southern Indiana since 1922, with residential and business internet, voice, and security services. Smithville, local pride, global technology. Information at smithville.net. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. Information about Profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website, wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Mia Partlow, producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.